Fake news. They are fake.
Fake news is the worst thing.
He says it's more proof of fake news in the media.
These trolls were trying to create two different accounts.
Internet trolls are people lurking in cyberspace who launch attacks.
I think their primary objective was to create chaos in American politics.
Facebook has confirmed it has identified a coordinated political influence campaign.
It is a sweeping federal indictment that names individual Russians and details a highly orchestrated campaign to interfere with the U.S. election in 2016.
The Russians are using fake news to hack American democracy. And you were likely exposed to fake news because it's all part of an intricate web of internet trolls, tech giants like Facebook and Google, and of course, foreign agents. We know this now because of Jonathan Albright. If you've never heard of him before, you're not alone because he is special. He's actually one of the keys to understanding this mess. He tracks how fake news spreads around the web. His research helped break stories for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Guardian. Albright is the research director of Columbia's Tau Center for Digital Journalism. He's with us today explaining why fake news is the greatest threat to our democracy. Issy Lepowski is also here with us. She's a senior editor at Wired. She profiled Jonathan Albright in a piece called Shadow Politics, Meet the Digital Sleuth Exposing Fake News. Issy, Jonathan, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So Jonathan, in the profile for Wired, Issy describes you as not quite a journalist, not quite a coder, and certainly not your traditional social scientist. She goes on to write, you're a potent blend of all three, a tireless internet sleuth who can crack and crunch data and serve it up in scoops to the press. Now, she was laying the butter on thick, I know. But how do you describe yourself?
Well, you know, I would say I came from more of a, I guess, a hybrid professional and academic background, and I typically, I guess, my research style isn't you know, standard for academic work. I'm more exploratory than empirical, and I often use kind of any means necessary, whether that means, you know, spending time cleaning data or getting messy data and dealing with it later, and kind of recognizing certain cues that tend to lead to misinformation, propaganda, coordination, and campaigns.
It seems pretty academic.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that I would say that I try to keep my work in the academic sector and use tools that are open source and not, you know, run kind of experimental studies that are looking at control groups, but more find trails that lead to certain types of information repositories and sources and Twitter accounts and Facebook pages.
So up until now, your work has been, for the most part, under the radar. And one of your earlier projects, I understand, looked at how journalists used hashtags. And given the way we operate today, I was so surprised to learn every academic journal you sent it to rejected it. Then you go on to help break some of the most important stories of the year in terms of how fake news and foreign influence spreads across the internet. You feel vindicated? Was this your "I told you so" year?
You know, in a way, I think that when I was studying hashtags, they were more for, I guess, social causes and for good things, for disaster coordination, for rescuing people after earthquakes, for promoting democracy in countries. And, you know, this was in 2011 and 2012. And I think that, you know, we've a lot of these new tools that we have kind of come into our lives on a daily basis, including hashtags, are now used to coordinate and promote other things that aren't necessarily, you know, the things that we want to deal with, or the things that we want to think about, or the things that we consider beneficial to society. So in a way, it is vindicating, but also in a way that, you know, there's another side to it, that we're entering kind of a new stage, which is a little bit unsettling.
It's deeply unsettling. Issy, as a character, why do you think Jonathan is so compelling? What about him draws you to him?
Yeah, well, it's obviously, you know, the extent of his research, but also the fact that Jonathan really has this ability to dial into the most minute details and really fixate on them while also pulling back and seeing what the bigger picture is. So often a lot of my conversations with Jonathan, he'll, you know, go on and on about what he's found in these, you know, little ad tracking tools that he's found. And, you know, we're talking about the most minute details of what could be a, you know, a massive disinformation campaign. And I just have to stop and be like, okay, so wait, what does this mean though? What are you saying? And he still can dial that back. And I think that that's something you don't see a lot in academia. People, you know, will be very precise about the research that they're presenting, but be very timid to draw like overarching conclusions about it. Mm-hmm. But I think Jonathan has these instincts about the broader context of where these minute details that he's found fit into the overall landscape of news and information spreading online.
Your work is excellent, Issy, and I was struck by that evening you described. Now, Jonathan, that article takes us back to the evening after President Trump was elected, the night when you were looking at a spreadsheet of all these different websites that were known for spreading fake news, trying to connect the dots, even though your computer kept on crashing. Now, how long had you been working that night on that spreadsheet?
Well, you know, I would say that when I started that first research quest, I call them, you know, I, it's something that I kind of had an idea or a spark kind of came, and I typically work, you know, I work fairly late. I mean, late meaning, you know, 3 or 4 in the morning. Once you get into this kind of data, and often once you're collecting data, especially because things are being taken down very quickly, increasingly quickly, you know, we can't get to even the cache version of websites, apps are being removed. So typically any data that you can get or any kind of information that you can store or capture somehow, you want to do that immediately. And there's kind of, you know, waiting until the next day sometimes really isn't an option.
How many hours straight had you been working?
I mean, I still slept, of course, but you know, I was working around 15 hours, 16 hours a day. I mean, that would probably be a kind of just moderate estimate.
I have this image of you like the Matrix and you're Neo and you're sitting in front of the computer with this huge spreadsheet. What did you discover?
Well, on the first round, what I started to see was this perspective of political misinformation kind of from a bird's eye view, or I would say, you know, from an ecosystem level. So it really gave insight into cross-platform manipulation. So this is kind of one of the first glimpses that we've had of how these connections exist between platforms. So not just looking at Facebook as a research object, which would be more academic, or looking at Twitter as kind of a standalone object, but actually looking at how these different components of the media environment that we live in and the ways that we share kind of all come together as a living and breathing and kind of dynamic ecosystem.
So you were looking at the links between each of these platforms or websites like Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all those things. Is that right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say that it went, you know, quite a ways beyond websites. So, you know, what some of the websites were in there, but, you know, this goes all the way into things, the IP addresses, the servers. So the kinds of servers that were being used, the hosting providers that, you know, so it goes a few layers, I guess, underneath what you would consider kind of a typical website.
As you're describing it, it seems complicated. You spend so many hours, there's so many data points, it goes beyond websites. But out of all of that, you create this data visualization for the first time that shows people how misinformation spread around the web. What is that network like?
Well, you know, I think that it shows the mainstream media or the larger kind of institutional media might be a better word than mainstream media, but it shows them kind of at the center of this ecosystem that is surrounded by on a kind of the periphery of not necessarily all fake news, but you know, smaller kind of nodes, WordPress blogs, Twitter accounts, Facebook pages that are all kind of trying to influence this conversation and often in coordination. So it kind of shows the scale at which to these sources of unreliable information kind of push agendas out and specifically use like signal coordination to kind of all broadcast something at the same time to really flood whether, you know, social media or kind of news sites with certain types of information And, you know, it could be something that would be disinformation, which would be false. And it also could be something that, you know, could be a poor angle or kind of a bad angle on something that already exists as a news topic.
Fascinating. You said a couple of things which slightly went over my head, but for anyone who's just joining us, Jonathan Albright is research director at Columbia's Taos Center for Digital Journalism, and he's here. We're talking about fake news in America. There was recently a profile of him in Wire magazine that Issy Lepowski wrote. You mentioned a coordinated effort to influence the media. What is being coordinated? I don't quite understand that.
Well, I mean, there's a few different areas of coordination that I would say are you know, for example, just the kind of trending debates. What ends up trending on some of the social media platforms, especially Facebook and especially Twitter, whether it be a hashtag or the news topic of the day. Often these things are meant to set agendas, and especially for to reach media influencers. So Twitter, for example, you know, it's used by normal people, I suppose, but really the core audience for Twitter is more journalistic and more political, and I would say more kind of influence focused. So the ways that the operations and the kind of topics that are put out and the links that are put out back to stories have certain types of agendas, and they're meant to make what would normally be a non-issue or something that might never be brought to the surface, such as, you know, a conspiracy, such as something like Pizzagate. They're meant to kind of draw those out and pull those to the surface and make those something that is, you know, to materialize these otherwise probably things that would never reach the top or reach the surface of the agenda for the news of the day.
You were a main source behind the New York Times story about Russian trolls using Facebook to stoke American rage and divisiveness, right?
I mean, sure, I guess. I mean, I wouldn't say it was the main source. Sure, why not?
How would you describe it?
Yeah, well, I think that story relied on a lot of the images that Jonathan was able to pull shortly after Facebook announced that, you know, Russian trolls had manipulated the platform. The reason that Jonathan proved so critical at that time was because Facebook wasn't showing people much of what was out there. So they said, yes, that there were, you know, X number of accounts. I believe it was 470 pages. They bought 3,500 ads, but we weren't seeing anything. And Jonathan, you know, through this nifty kind of workaround that he discovered, was able to archive just, you know, I don't even know how many, Jonathan, but a lot of the ads and the content that those Russian trolls were sharing. So that New York Times story pulled from what Jonathan had found, because at the time, Facebook wasn't really sharing much information.
Oh, my goodness. For a while, we thought it was just Facebook that was vulnerable, but now we know that there was so much more there. Jonathan, what more is there? What else should we be careful with?
Well, I think that we have to be skeptical of, you know, almost anything that is circulating online. I mean, we can kind of defer to trusted sources, which will help. But in the future, you know, as we move especially into very advanced image manipulation and video manipulation, that is hard to, you know, at some point we're going to have to kind of resort to organizations and professionals who kind of deal in this area as a service or a job, because for regular people and even for, you know, I mean, for all of us, it's going to become impossible to tell fact from fiction. I mean, once the kind of AI and once, you know, they're calling it deep fakes, once these things really come into the mainstream and once the tools get distributed where, you know, everyone has access to some of these image manipulation tools, I think that it'll become a lot harder. So we rely on text right now a lot, but we're moving into quickly into the kind of image-based phase, which is a lot harder to analyze and make sense of.
So there'll come a time when we can't even believe the photographs and the video that we're watching.
I mean, I would say we're almost there. Videos are a little bit more difficult, but yeah, we're definitely moving into that era.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I'm speaking with Jonathan Albright. He's research director at Columbia's Taos Center for Digital Journalism, along with journalist Issy Lepowski. She profiled him for Wired.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to The Midday Show on WNYC, and we're talking with Issy Lipowski and Jonathan Albright about fake news and how Russians may have hacked American democracy. Jonathan, you had mapped out all these links between the sources of bad information on the web, and then eventually Facebook comes out and admits that they sold 3,000 ads promoting divisive social and political messages. And then Facebook told us that these posts reached about 10 million users. We knew that this was bad, but no one really knew the scope of how bad it was until the Washington Post published your research, which showed these posts could have been shared hundreds of millions, if not billions of times. And this was incredibly important because it proved not only how vulnerable we are to foreign influence, but also how little Facebook itself knew about how their own platform was being manipulated, or at least how little they were willing to tell us. How did you figure this out before the media, before the politicians, and before tech companies knew what was going on?
Well, this would kind of go into analytics and really tracing back signals and accounts, and you know, it's a lot of time spent looking at, you know, hashtags and kind of the, all of the ways that information was being shared. And, you know, I guess I'd study this in general. I study this topic. So, I had a lot of kind of observations that existed, you know, through the elections, all going all the way back to the primaries. So I was able to take a lot of information and use it along with some of the accounts that had been released by the New York Times and the Daily Beast. And there were some kind of names of the accounts that started to come out in September. And get some data on them and kind of use that and bootstrap from there and kind of take and expand the networks bit by bit and kind of piece by piece and making sure that I was getting, you know, the right accounts. And so it was an iterative process where I kind of built over time network and connected these together to, you know, form what I thought was at least some of the core network of what the accounts that had been claimed that were, you know, influencing the election, so during 2016.
And how many are we talking about that you collected?
Well, I had quite a few at the time, and it was this really interesting, very frustrating process where you sent the names of suspected accounts to Facebook indirectly through reporters, and you know, you wait for a few days, and you would, you know, either get a non-response or you would get the, you know, these aren't part of the pages that we've identified. So it was a really frustrating. So I thought I actually had new accounts that would come out, or I thought I could break kind of these new pages. But what I ended up doing is I fell back to my kind of safety, which was the accounts that had already been identified, which was, you know, maybe the best thing that I could have done in the end. But it was, you know, the most boring option at the time.
The most boring option. You see, Facebook is basically trying to downplay just how bad this situation is, right?
Yeah, and especially at the time, that's why they came out with the number of, you know, people that the ads reached, right? They wanted us to think it was 10 million. And Jonathan's research was looking at this tool that showed, okay, how many people could these possibly have reached? So that took into account every follower of every page he was looking at, which is and assuming they all saw every single piece of content that they shared, which is why he came up with such a huge number. Eventually, Facebook told Congress that I think 125 million people had seen the organic content on Facebook. That's the post that, you know, the Russian trolls didn't pay for. They were just posting, and if you followed them, you would see them. And then there were another, I'm sure Jonathan will correct me if I'm wrong, but another 20 million or so on Instagram. And I would say Jonathan was also instrumental in pointing out Instagram, because for a long time, it was Facebook. But let's not forget how pivotal Instagram is. And what Jonathan had found was that, you know, there was just as much activity, if not more, on Instagram. And it was getting really high engagement. And some of this was really divisive stuff. So he, you know, sort of nudged reporters to dig into these things. And Facebook eventually came out with more and more information.
Now, are we satisfied by this information now? Or do you think that there's still more missing?
Well, I think what we found this week is that it's ongoing, right? So the original accounts that Facebook announced last fall, and that Jonathan was looking into, you know, that was sort of the first wave. But, you know, this week Facebook has said we found another, you know, batch of 32 accounts and pages across Instagram and Facebook that are involved in inauthentic coordinated behavior. That means they are fake accounts that they've determined somehow that are working together to spread one message or another. So I think what we can assume is that there's always more out there. And we can hope that Facebook will catch it and be more transparent about it and work more closely with law enforcement to investigate the origins of these things than they did last time. But no, I don't think we're anywhere close to seeing the end of the scope of this thing.
Nowhere near seeing the end of the scope of this. Jonathan, if we could go deeper into some of your research, I understand the way you got all this data was essentially by exploiting a bug?
Well, so that was specifically for just the Facebook post and the kind of the archive of some of those Facebook pages and the official numbers. So when I was able to use the analytics tool called CrowdTangle, which Facebook had acquired about a year before, I wanted, there's lots of ways to get data on some of these suspected propaganda or misinformation accounts. But I wanted to get something that was more official, right? So you know, if you pull it from another source, companies can often kind of claim that, you know, the way they measure or the inputs they use for these, the reaches and the page likes are often, they're not right. But if you use kind of the product that's built in-house, I felt that that would be something that would be much harder to dispute, and it obviously was.
If we could tackle a little bit what Issy was talking about earlier with the Facebook, with this latest batch of accounts that Facebook says could be suspect. To be fair, we don't know for sure whether the Russians were behind the newest accounts that Facebook took down. But doesn't it seem extremely similar to the activity that you tracked in the past?
Yeah, so I would say they released a few names of the pages. Some of them, and I would say that the largest ones in this new batch have certain characteristics that kind of make them similar to the older accounts. Just the way they post, the cadence of how they kind of usually do very short posts, which are a photo kind of captioned, and then they follow, one out of every 12 or 15 posts with kind of a very long divisive issue, and just the way they're managed. Some of the other ones, they don't seem to fit the kind of mold that at least I'm familiar with, some of the smaller ones. But, we're talking about pages that have, seven followers or less than, 1,000 followers. So, but the larger ones, I would say, kind of do fit that mold. So, and they have some of the numbers to kind of show that maybe they were growing, so they were kind of, most of these would be relatively new. So it takes time. And when those accounts were taken down back last year, they were, they'd been on a nonstop growth curve since the election. So they were headed upwards towards the midterms when all of those accounts were taken down.
So Issy, what's your reaction to this?
I'm encouraged by the fact that Facebook is being upfront about it, because that's something that in the past we've sort of seen them retrench and not want to share any information. I would say they're still not being totally forthcoming, but they have, shared this information with law enforcement, and they're coming out with some preliminary information before they know the extent of the problem. So often the problem with Facebook is they want to have the whole problem mapped out and the solution mapped out before they tell you anything. Right. And they want the solution. And so we've seen that again and again. That happened in the aftermath of the Cambridge Analytica scandal, when it came out that, Facebook had been leaking all this data to app developers. Mark Zuckerberg didn't say anything about it for days and days and days, even as the stock price was tanking. So this time around, they are, they've said that they're recommitting to transparency. And so they did get, Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer, on the phone with journalists to talk about how they discovered this, what we know now, we're going to continue looking. And I think that's encouraging. But I think that, yeah, it's by their own admission, it's only going to get harder to spot these things because, what they looked for to spot the Russian trolls were things like Russian IP addresses and paying in rubles and this coordination that Jonathan was talking about. Now, if this is the Russians, then they're doing a lot more to hide their tracks. They're using VPNs to disguise their IP addresses. They're hiring third parties to purchase ads. These are all things that Facebook has told us so far. So I think that it's only getting more challenging for Facebook, but I'm encouraged by their transparency so far.
We're all encouraged by their transparency. I remember that day when Mark Zuckerberg went in front of Congress. This is a clip of him.
Facebook is an idealistic and optimistic company, but it's clear now that we didn't do enough to prevent these tools from being used for harm as well. And that goes for fake news, for foreign interference in elections and hate speech, as well as developers and data privacy. We didn't take a broad enough view of our responsibility, and that was a big mistake. And it was my mistake, and I'm sorry.
Clearly, this was bad for PR. And now the company seems to be trying to be a bit more proactive by letting us know how their platform is being used to harm our democracy. Now, obviously, you have some questions about this, Issy. Jonathan, you do too. But in terms of the normal person, what can we do to insulate ourselves? We heard Mark Zuckerberg apologize. We know that there's more information coming out. What do we do as we are racing toward the midterm elections?
Well, I think, you know, voters have to, you know, be aware that this kind of disinformation is out there. The awareness will hopefully breed some skepticism, and you hope that that skepticism is geared in the right direction, not toward, you know, institutional media like the New York Times that's, you know, getting a lot of flack from the president on down, but toward these newer sites, these pages that are coming up that are spreading memes that are unsubstantiated but gaining tons of traction and engagement. You hope that the electorate is becoming more attuned to the real problem of fake news and not just the catchphrase of fake news. And then with regard to, you know, other issues like the Cambridge Analytica thing that Mark Zuckerberg was talking about in that soundbite, you know, I think it's important that people are aware of privacy concerns, that you're not just logging into every app you have with Facebook, because you don't know how that data is going to be used. You're interacting with that app via a third party. And I think very few people are paying attention to the permissions that Facebook is giving to these app developers. So be more cautious about the data you give away and about how you're protecting your privacy online.
Jonathan?
So, I mean, I think that I agree with everything that Issy said. And also, I think that we need to be something that kind of came up as a repeated, you know, observation when I was looking at all this, through all this data in the past couple of years, is that there's a lot of preying on people's kind of reactions, and it tends to spread things very quickly. So, you know, just thinking or pausing before you hit like, or you hit or share, or you hit, you know, you use the reaction emojis, can go a long way into slowing down some of these things that are being pushed out. Waiting, you know, for a few hours or until the next day, and just until you get a better sense of what's happening before something is being pushed out or shared in a social network and on Twitter as well. So just slowing things down actually goes a long way into countering the effects of propaganda and misinformation.
So you're singularly successful in spotting fake news, but there's a whole community of people that are growing, and they want to track, to hunt down these people who are putting out fake news. Any advice for them? What kinds of computers are you using? I imagine you with this huge computer, or are you just using your regular laptop in a coffee shop? Where
you know, I mean, it really, it's nothing that requires, I think that a lot of this work is, it's nothing that requires some, like a supercomputer. I mean, you need, you know, a basic computer that can handle, you know, a lot of open programs, but I think it's more in the methodology and in the types of ways that you, in kind of the sequence of how you look for one thing and kind of use another tool to maybe pull data. And there's a lot of trial and error, so it's kind of back and forth. And like I said, I mean, sometimes, you know, the best thing that you can do for some, in some cases is just take a screenshot, right? I mean, screenshot is, again, this is more of a very basic, like, boring research tool, but screenshots are very important into capturing evidence. But of course, screenshots can also be doctored just like other images.
And what are you working on next? What is the next great scoop?
Well, I mean, the thing is that I'm often, managing multiple projects, so I'm kind of taking in data on kind of a variety of things, and sometimes they rise to the surface. So, you know, I was looking at InfoWars as kind of where I've been looking at InfoWars for a while, but I'm kind of looking at them as a larger entity across, you know, all the platforms. And of course, I'm looking at some of the accounts that were released recently by Facebook. But I usually kind of juggle multiple projects. And when one kind of surfaces to the zeitgeist of you know, the topic of the day or the misinformation of the kind of, you know, month, I guess, that I'm often working to help journalists and kind of get them information or help them make sure that some of their statistics or their, you know, the data on these accounts or the way that they present them are framed correctly. I mean, so my job is interesting as kind of an academic who also kind of liaises with certain reporters and journalists and kind of helps them make sure that they're on track and centered around like factual information, especially data.
So despite what Facebook did by releasing these accounts and letting us know about this, there are a lot of people out there who still believe that Facebook, Google, YouTube, they're just not doing enough to stop fake news and bad information. Do you think that's because they don't know how to or because they don't want to? You see?
Well, I think that, you know, Jonathan brought up InfoWars. This has been sort of a hot topic. Why is InfoWars still allowed to, you know, propagate on Facebook and YouTube? Why isn't this violating their community standards? They're spreading hoaxes. They're in some cases inciting violence. And so I think this is a really hard needle for Facebook and for YouTube and other platforms to thread because they're already getting accused of bias from the right. We've had several congressional hearings where, you know, they've been accused of tanking certain conservative voices reach on their platforms, and they don't want to get into a debate about every single publisher on their platforms. So they say, you know, we have these community standards, and when we see very clear evidence that, you know, somebody has violated them, then we take these established actions. But they don't want to get into a debate about everyone. But fortunately for them, they're in that debate anyway. So we recently saw both Facebook and YouTube take down some of these InfoWars videos. Facebook suspended Alex Jones's personal page, but left up the InfoWars page. So there are all these, you know, ways. And of course, you know, it is engagement for them. If we're going to be cynical about it, you know, they do have huge audiences, and those audiences will be really pissed off if suddenly Alex Jones and InfoWars disappear. So I think that, you know, It's both. It's that Facebook doesn't, they want to do this on some level, but they also don't, they see the road ahead and they don't want to be on it.
Well, thank you both for looking towards that road ahead, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm Duarte Geraldino, and I've been speaking with Jonathan Albright, the research director at Columbia's Tau Center for Digital Journalism, along with journalist Issy Lepowski, who profiled him for Wired.